Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as, well, an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. And it is my distinct privilege to say that there are few people I've gotten to know and admire more in terms of chroniclers of that war, people who have deeply studied it and understood it and helped the rest of us do the same, than the man who has graciously given a full hour of his time for us to talk with him today about that and much more. His name is Dr. Paul Kengor. He is a professor of political science, as well as the executive director of the Center for Vision and Values at the Grove City College in my native Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. He is a multiple times best-selling New York Times author for such incredibly important books as A Pope and a President, John Paul II, Ronald Reagan, and the Extraordinary Untold Story of the 20th Century, Principles of a Reagan Conservative, Dupes, How America's Adversaries Have Manipulated Progressives for a Century, and many more. Paul Kengor, it is a supreme pleasure to have you with us to have a conversation about so many topics that seem to be both of relevance to previous phases of this war for the free world, as well as very much in evidence today. Bless you, sir, and the work you do at Grove City, and thank you for joining us to talk about it.
Wow, Frank, you're way too kind, and to quote my old friend Bill Clark, you're easily misled.
Well, I'm sold on you, that's for sure, and I'm so glad to have a chance to talk with you, as was Bill Clark, a man I admire greatly. Let me ask you for sort of starters. I'd like to talk about a number of things in connection with Reagan and insights that you've gleaned from your study of him over the years. As you know, I had the privilege of serving him for about 4.5 years, but your perspective over the course of his life is what I really want to draw upon. And in particular, I wanted to run by you a proposition, Paul Kengor, and that is that I'm convinced that the world we find ourselves in today, this phase of what President Reagan called every generation's existential threat to freedom, is at least as dangerous as those that he faced in his time, and arguably before that. What do you think?
I think it's a very good point, Frank. I mean, in the sense that what we're facing now is so unpredictable, right? I mean, at least in Ronald Reagan's time, you knew the ideology. The ideology was Bolshevism. I mean, that was the primary threat. You had this kind of interim period of Nazism from about 1938, 39 to 45 on the world stage, in terms of when Nazism really became a serious international threat. And then that was gone. And it was picked up again by the other totalitarian.
It was removed, I think, is a better way of describing
it. Yes, exactly right. In fact, unfortunately, the comparison to communism is that we still have people in the West that are celebrating Marxism. You know, we're here in May 2018, the bicentennial of the birth of Marx, and all these leftists in America are talking about what a great man Marx was. At least they don't say that about Hitler, right?
Well, it's interesting that they don't, even though the successors to Marx, the people who applied his policies, did vastly more genocidal mayhem than Adolf Hitler did in the entire, you know, Holocaust and the rest of the war. It's stunning in a way, and it's something I'd like to talk with you about, Paul, but maybe we can reserve on that for a moment. Why is it that communists get a pass, whereas Nazis are properly understood to be horrific people? But just on this point about the existential threats to freedom, as you say, there have been a number of them. Communism has been one that has abided. In fact, we've got a delegation off talking to Chinese communists as we speak and trying to figure out how much war they're at with us. But Paul, as you look at President Reagan and the philosophy that he called peace through strength, that he applied during his presidency to great effect, I wonder if you'd indulge me in a question about, again, comparisons. It seems to me that what Reagan confronted when he came to office after the 4 years of Jimmy Carter's disastrous administration was a military that had been, to be sure, hollowed out, as it was called, but that essentially all he needed to do was, well, I think of it as a plant that needs water and maybe a little Miracle-Gro, and it sprung back to life. The industrial base was there, the will to, you know, fight and to have our, you know, military be second to none and so on was something that could be tapped into again, and congressional support was in evidence on both sides of the aisle. Not so much today. It seems as though Barack Obama was kind of pulling that plant, if you will, up by the roots. How do you see that?
Yeah, no, I think that's a good analogy. And so, I mean, the seeds were there with our military and what had been done post-World War II and, you know, the building up of the military, National Security Act of 1947, NSC 68 back in 1950, you know, what had been done with in the Kennedy years. And then all of a sudden, with the post-Watergate situation, post-Vietnam situation, you had this drawdown in the military, this de-escalation, almost an undermining of the military. I mean, we genuinely had people in the military on food stamps. I mean, there were shortages of parts. And so, you know, the infrastructure was there, but it had been deprived. And then Ronald Reagan, of course, bolstered it. You were there, Frank, right? 600-ship Navy, Strategic Defense Initiative.
Rebuilding the nuclear deterrent, right?
That's right.
We're still living off of what he did all these years later, in fact.
That's right. So really, I mean, what you could have here right now, kind of the same sort of thing, where there was the drawdown in the 1990s, post-Cold War, and then George W. Bush with the buildup again after 9/11. And then in comes Barack Obama, sort of Carter-like with the military and foreign policy. And so now the stage is set here for Trump to be able to do what Ronald Reagan did and you know, start investing in the military again. And here's another kind of Cold War analogy. The biggest threat right now out there on the global stage, first of all, I still think it's radical Islam, but at least at the very current moment, as you and I are speaking on what's going on in the world this week, next couple of weeks, is a communist threat, right, with North Korea and China. Of all things. So North Korea, the one place in the world, the DMZ, the 38th parallel, where the Cold War continues on. And so here, of all things, the biggest current battle at the moment on President Trump and our new Secretary of State's plate is an old communist battle against a Stalinist dictator in North Korea. And here, too, I would warn Donald Trump and Pompeo and others who aren't likely to be duped. I see these pictures right now of a smiling little jolly Kim who looks like a guy you'd want to go out and have a beer with.
Koala bear.
Yeah, exactly. Like give him a little hug and a kiss like Jimmy Carter did to Brezhnev, right?
But it ain't necessarily so. And we're going to talk more about that with you, Paul Kengor, right after we take a short break. One of the great historians of our time and biographer of Ronald Reagan and brilliant observer of our situation at the moment and the lessons we should be learning from the past. Right after that, with Paul Kengor.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back. We are visiting this full hour with a great historian, a great chronicler of our time as well as the past, and a great friend. He is Dr. Paul Kengor of the Grove City College, where he is a professor of political science and the executive director of its Center for Vision and Values. We're talking about lessons from the Reagan era for our own time, and it's a very full plate. He has chronicled the Reagan years marvelously in a series of biographies about the president himself and about some of his senior hands, including Top Hand, as he called him, Judge William P. Clark. Paul Kengor, let me ask you just to pick up on something we were discussing a moment ago before the break. The difference that it seems to me operates at the moment is I think Donald Trump gets it that we're in a dangerous world. He explicitly embraces the proposition that we need to return to peace through strength. What I think must be of concern to him, and certainly should be to the rest of us, is that it isn't possible to simply go in and say to the U.S. defense industrial base, I want, you know, a massive buildup of our military power right now. I want all of the spare parts we need to get all of the Hangar Queens out of out of our Air Force and Navy deployed units. I want to get the new weapon systems that are needed to meet today's threats, and I want to get the vast expansion of the kinds of capabilities we'll need to deal with the future ones. That's basically what President Reagan put in train, and he could do it because, as we've been discussing, so much was still there. It just had been deprived for 4 years. Not so much now. To that extent, I fear that it is creating in the minds of adversaries, you've mentioned two of them, China and North Korea. You could throw in Russia, those Iranians and other global jihadists perhaps as well, who have been emboldened, I fear, by what they've seen the United States do unilaterally under the 8 years of Obama, most especially.
Yeah, no, it's a good point, Frank. I mean, it's a different America. It's a different American economy. It's a different industrial base. I mean, we have a much larger GDP, of course, than we did in 1980. The economy, though, today is much more diverse in a positive sense, but also in a negative sense for exactly your point on how could we kind of ramp up if we needed to. You know, the phrase that I always like to use about what Reagan did in the 1980s that a lot of the people on the liberal left either didn't understand or didn't want to understand is Reagan wanted to build up in order to build down, right? So he wanted to build up the nuclear arsenal, build up a peace through strength in order to bring the Russians to the negotiating table. So then the Russians would be forced to actually cut their nuclear arsenals. So first you had to build up in order to build down. But he was able to do that in a way very quickly that I don't know if Donald Trump would be able to do that today or not. And also, try to imagine Ronald Reagan on March 23rd, 1983, going out and giving to a nationally televised audience something like the SDI address, the Strategic Defense Initiative address, and have people immediately rally to that. Of course, not before Senator Ted Kennedy the very next morning goes out on the Senate floor and makes fun of it as, quote, reckless Red Scare schemes and Star Wars, you know, made fun of it. So I don't even know it's hard to even picture Donald Trump doing something like that today. But in terms of some other generating, operating Reagan-esque principles, the one that I always think of, Frank, from Reagan that I think Trump needs to take into his dealings with an ex-lieutenant colonel of the KGB, Vladimir Putin, Reagan said, one of my favorite quotes, "We learned long ago that in negotiating with the Russians, you had to have a dove of peace in one hand and a sword in the other." So you can't take – I was worried during the campaign with Trump. I'm not so much worried about it now. But a naivete he showed during the campaign where he kept saying of Putin, "He likes me, he likes me, he likes me." That's a fatal mistake. That's what FDR literally said about Stalin, right? "He likes me, he likes – they're really good at making you think that they like you. And then once they get you to think that way, that's when they manipulate you."
Yeah. This is such an important point, Paul. We who have worked under or watched closely, as you have, the various presidents have – I think seen this fatal conceit play out again and again and again, where whether it's an illusion about somebody liking you or not, it's that your personal chemistry somehow is transcending national interests. And I even saw that, quite candidly, as much of an admirer as I am of Ronald Reagan, operating a bit with Gorbachev.
That's exactly right. In fact, so I'll give you two cases of that. One with FDR. I mean, FDR was just, you know, so impressed with his own personal chemistry, right? That he believed, and this is off the top of my head, but it's one of the most infamous quotes ever from FDR. He said, "I believe that if I give Stalin everything he asks for and asks for nothing else in return, noblesse oblige," he even used those words, "that Stalin will work with me in the post-war situation to build a world of democracy and peace." He actually said that. That's almost verbatim. I use that quote in Dupes and everywhere else. I know it so well at this point. It's scandalously naive.
Yeah. It's presumably what Alger Hiss was whispering in his ear at the Yalta conference that, you know, translated into a very different kind of post-World War II world. Paul, let me just come back to this question of adversaries that we need to be alive to, perceiving this presidential, you know, charm and openness to their blandishments, to say nothing of that bigger context of an America that has been diminishing its strength, its military strength, its economic strength to some extent as well. You mentioned Communist China and North Korea. There will be evidently, as things stand out at least, a summit between Kim Jong-un and President Trump. The Chinese are unmistakably playing a role behind the scenes. Give us just a quick assessment of the history here and the likelihood of success in negotiating with totalitarians under these sorts of circumstances, and what sorts of things should the president be particularly alive to?
Well, it's a good point. In fact, our history of negotiating with totalitarians has never gone very well. And, you know, there again, you can start with FDR and Stalin at Yalta. And just about a week or two before FDR suddenly died, I think it was around mid-April 1945, and he said to Anna Rosenberg, he said, you know, Avril, meaning Avril Harriman of all people, he said, "Avril is right. We can't trust Stalin. He's already broken every single promise he made to me at Yalta." And that was just like 6 weeks after Yalta. He had already seen every single promise broken. Now, with Reagan always said that he felt that if he could just get a Soviet leader in a room, one-on-one together, that he could really work his charm. You know, he could negotiate with them. And Reagan was lucky in the sense that negotiator, that interlocutor, became Mikhail Gorbachev and not Yuri Andropov, right? Not Nikita Khrushchev, not Leonid Brezhnev. And Gorbachev certainly has his faults. And to this day, says that his goal had been to preserve the USSR. At least Mikhail Gorbachev was a decent human being, right? He wasn't a mass perjurer or murderer on the scale of a Pol Pot or a Stalin or a man filled with hatred like Vladimir Lenin.
Let me just interrupt on this point because it's so important, I think. If I'm thanking God for anything, it's really that Mikhail Gorbachev didn't come along until sufficiently late in the game. That the strategy that President Reagan had put together with the man you've magnificently depicted, Judge William P. Clark, President Reagan's second national security advisor, had helped develop, as you've documented, a strategy for defeating and ultimately destroying the Soviet Union. And it was really too late. Even if Gorbachev were more ruthless, I think probably it was too late, but certainly a guy who wasn't was unable to turn this thing around, thank God. So there's that piece of it, too. It's not just the man. It was the timing and the limitations on his ability to do other than what he what he wound up doing, which was going along with the dismantling of the Soviet Union.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And in fact, sources as diverse as Edmund Morris, Reagan's biographer, and even some of the Gorbachev biographers, they point out that Yuri Andropov was grooming Mikhail Gorbachev as his chosen successor, in part, as Edmund Morris, of all people, put it, because they thought that only Gorbachev had the energy and the charisma to be able to deal with Reagan. So in a way, Reagan helped create Gorbachev, right? So it was that first Reagan term, and guys like Bill Casey at the CIA, Bill Clark at the NSC, Cap Weinberger at the Pentagon, those guys working with Reagan through peace, through strength, allowed for Gorbachev and what happened in the second term. So they helped create that positive dynamic. The situation today in Russia, today with China, with Vladimir Putin, who you know this as well as anybody. So he comes in 2000. He was supposed to be there for no more than 8 years. He's president, then prime minister, then prime minister, then president. He changes the constitution. We're now at 2018. The guy is not very old. I think Putin, unless something happens to Putin, the guy's going to be there until he dies of old age. So this is a totally different situation in Russia today. And Putin is not a Marxist-Leninist, but he's more of a traditional Russian authoritarian and a bad guy.
And a guy who, not least, as you know so well, Paul Kinger, thinks that the greatest disaster of the 20th century was the fall of the Soviet Union, which has some pretty heavy-duty competition for that distinction. So this is a guy who is motivated, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but motivated by a desire for not only a restoration to the extent he can of Russia's place in the world as a great power, but also getting even.
Yes. Yeah, it very well could be. He sees the USSR as the collapse, as indeed, you're right, you had the exact words, you know, the great geopolitical catastrophe of the last century. And he wants today some form of greater Russia.
Yeah. We'll talk about that and much more with Paul Kinger after a short break. We'll be right back.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. We are visiting with Dr. Paul Kinger of Grove City College, the author among many, many important books of a personal favorite of mine, The Crusader, Ronald Reagan, and the Fall of Communism. Paul, we've of course just been talking about what Reagan did to bring that about through a counter-ideological strategy, in part through the use of all instruments of national power, including notably economic power. And I want to come back to that in a minute, but it has embittered Vladimir Putin. And one of the things that it seems that he's been particularly determined to do is to reverse the strategic balance in terms of nuclear forces that he inherited. Barack Obama has helped by contributing to the obsolescence of ours. He's been rapidly modernizing his. He's got systems that apparently will overcome the missile defenses that we have put into place, modest though they may be, that President Reagan essentially commissioned initially. Your sense about that strategic context and how much more dangerous that makes this business with Putin at the moment?
Yeah, there's no question that's what he's doing, Frank. And you and I both remember in the mid-1990s, in the Yeltsin era, when the end of the Cold War and the USSR had been taken apart, and the Russian economy at that point was in a depression that was actually even worse than our Great Depression. And that really literally pained someone like Vladimir Putin to watch all of that happen. And there was a joke at the time that modern Russia was the equivalent of Bangladesh with nuclear rockets, right? And as they started decommissioning those nukes, as they started getting older, then it was just getting down to Russia was much better than Bangladesh. The economy really turned around 1998, 1999, thanks to energy reserves. Putin became the choice of both Yeltsin and the Duma for prime minister. That was 1999, after the Russians had Yeltsin had gone through like five different prime ministers. Viktor Chernomyrdin was one of them. So they end up with Putin, and then Putin is there literally at the end of the millennium when Yeltsin stunned the world. December 31st, 1999, he announced he was going to be retiring, that Putin was his chosen successor. And so Putin comes in, won an election. That one seemed to be legitimate. I think that was March 26, 2000. And then once he came in, he said, okay, we're no longer going to be Bangladesh. We're not going to be Bangladesh with decommissioned nuclear rockets. We're going to build up the arsenal. And so this has been a major part of his bid for a stronger, greater Mother Russia. And adding to that, my friend Herb Meyer, who was the right-hand man of Bill Casey at the CIA, likes to say that Russia is like Saudi Arabia, except the sand in Russia's case is energy reserves. So if they could get those energy reserves rolling, if they could get the economy rolling, which they seem to be doing, you're looking at a situation today of a Russia led by a former KGB guy that is actually considerably economically stronger than the Soviet Union ever was.
And arguably has a vastly larger and more modern strategic arsenal, more dangerous strategic arsenal than the Soviets did at their heyday. It may not be quantitatively larger, but in terms of the quality and the precision and the lethality of the weapons, including now hypersonic weapons, which Paul Kanger, I believe Hillary Clinton helped them obtain during the Obama years through a transaction that hasn't gotten as much attention as her uranium transfers at Uranium One. But this deal called Skolkovo, this cries out for a little bit of an historian's perspective, and we'll come back to you about that. Let me ask you about this business about China. We've been talking about nuclear threats. China's developed quite a formidable nuclear arsenal while we were trying to rid the world of nuclear weapons, it turns out, including, as you may remember, something on the order of 3,000 miles of underground hardened tunnels in which to conceal their nuclear arsenal. This is the country that is enabling North Korea. This is the country that that is, I believe, actively pursuing asymmetric threats against our country, some of which are being, I think, discussed as we speak in Beijing with the president's economic team. But your thoughts on China as well, Paul, and looking back on it today, you know, what would a Ronald Reagan think about that current leadership and its apparent attachment to resuscitating a bygone era in China's time, Mao's form of communism?
Yeah, Reagan wouldn't be surprised, Frank. You know, he referred to the Chinese in a private letter in the 1970s as a bunch of murderous bums. He was very critical of Nixon abandoning Chiang Kai-shek and turning and recognizing the People's Republic of China in order to get along, detente, accommodation. So Reagan was never very comfortable with the Chinese. He did like in the 1980s the fact that Deng Xiaoping was moving away from Mao and modernizing the country and introducing free markets. And at one point in the 1980s, they were kind of, in a way, one of our closest allies in going against the Soviet Union. And then came Tiananmen Square. Then came the collapse of the Cold War. Then came the collapse of the Soviet Union, I should add. And so ever since then, things have been much, much more chaotic. But where we are now is back to this. You have a situation with China, a communist leadership, a communist party-run country, which communists in a political sense more so than an economic sense. The economy continues to do very well. They must have the second largest GDP in the world, and they're very shrewd. They're very sly. They're very slick. Guys like you and I have been wondering for a long time. We're like, well, one of the reasons that we continue to stay close to the Chinese is because they can help us with North Korea, right? Well, they haven't done a damn thing to really help at all with North Korea.
To the contrary, they're the enablers of North Korea. And in fact, I'm fond of pointing out, Paul, as I'm sure you know, that those missiles that are driving around in the squares in Pyongyang to the delight of Kim Jong-un are on what are called transporter erector launchers supplied by the communist Chinese. So those missiles that are threatening us these days, increasingly these mobile missiles, are made in China, effectively, and a very, very worrying thing they're not being held accountable for. The president is going to be facing, again, challenges in all of these regards. And I'd like to come back to one other thing that you sort of alluded to a moment ago. One of Reagan's hallmarks, of course, in his strategy for taking down the Soviet Union, I think best enshrined in National Security Decision Directive 75, was an explicitly counter-ideological element to it. And one of the ideologies that we're confronting, in addition to whatever it is that Putin believes and sort of the communist doctrine, if not economics, I think it's more fascist, I guess, really, in terms of economics, but certainly communist in terms of its ideological leanings and doctrine. We're dealing with another ideology that I think is best described as Sharia supremacism. And I wonder what your thoughts are as to what President Reagan might make of, I think of it as communism with a God, Paul. and the extent to which it is really on the march these days around the world.
Or in a way, right, maybe totalitarianism with a God, right? Sharia supremacism is a good phrase. You know, Ronald Reagan at one point, and we have these now. In fact, I'm trying to think which one it was. It was one of the five summits with Gorbachev. It might have been Geneva, but there's MemCons, Memoranda of Conversation, that were declassified in the late 1990s, where Reagan is talking to Gorbachev about sharing SDI with the Soviets because of the possibility of one day a nuclear weapon launch from a Middle East Muslim madman, as Reagan sought. And Gorbachev, for whatever reason, didn't believe the United States would share SDI with him, or for various reasons that didn't go through. But the point here is, you know, Reagan was very suspicious and very concerned and about what would come from the Middle East. And Gorbachev would say, I don't understand, and liberals would say this too, I don't understand, Mr. Reagan, right? If the Soviets eliminate all of their nuclear missiles and we eliminate all of ours, then you don't need your SDI. What are you talking about?
Right. I think this was Reykjavik, if I'm not mistaken. I was there on the margins. But here's the thing, Paul. This is such an important point, and Reagan is just not given credit for it very much. He was looking over the horizon. He was looking towards the kind of world in which we find ourselves today with, in addition to what we've been discussing, of course, the proliferation of these ballistic missiles to all kinds of countries, including, you know, third world ones like North Korea and Iran that are capable, if not right now, very soon, to reach our own shores.
And Reagan said to Gorbachev, yeah, if each of us goes down to zero nuclear weapons, U.S. and the Soviet Union, China is still going to have them. He singled out China. He noted different Middle East countries, Iran in particular. He noted Iran. He was also worried at that point about Libya because of Gaddafi, and you can just, you know, switch Libya with whoever else that might be right now. But he was worried about a Middle East madman scenario, and liberals would also often say, Frank, you remember this? They say, oh, but SDI, if it's only 75% effective, then it can't take down 1,000 Russian nuclear missiles. And Reagan said, yeah, but it could take down one coming from the Middle East. And Reagan also used to say, you know, it's curious about liberals. They don't demand perfect success in their welfare programs, right? Yeah, I mean, no problem there, right? They don't even want 75% success in their welfare programs. It makes them feel good if they get even 10%. But they wanted perfect 100% effectiveness with SDI. But the Reagan thought was, okay, so it can't shoot down 100% of 5,000 Soviet nuclear warheads. But if you get enough platforms, if you get enough either space-based or ground-based missile defense, and you get a handful of missiles launched from the Middle East or wherever, and you get enough of our interceptors set up.
Paul Kinger, we have to take a final break. We will be right back with more straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We are back. It is, as I say, with the greatest of pleasure that I have been able to talk now for several segments with Paul Kinger. He has been a great inspiration to me, frankly, and I think to an awful lot of other people with the insights that he has gleaned from his close reading and writing of history, notably that of the Ronald Reagan presidency. One of your very important books, though, in addition to many that we've already discussed, Paul Kinger, that I want to call attention to is entitled The Communist, Frank Marshall Davis, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mentor. Communism is something that you've spent a lot of time studying and warning about, I think. And this was an important insight into what it was that Barack Obama was up to when he was fundamentally transforming America. But I thought we might start a conversation in this concluding segment, Paul, about those who have worked with our enemies or are doing so today to harm this country. And one is the feature of a major motion picture that is out at the moment. It's not on that subject, but it certainly sheds light on the man and his proclivities. And that is this film called Chappaquiddick about Teddy Kennedy. You described him earlier as one of the critics who I think really did immense harm to the effort to defend our country against these ballistic missile threats. But tell us a little bit about Teddy Kennedy's dealings with the Soviets in various moments during his long political career.
Oh, yeah, this was scandalous, Frank. Here's a summary of it as best as I can in a couple minutes. And in May 1983, and so this was the context of the coming 1984 presidential reelection campaign by President Reagan, Senator Kennedy confidentially reached out to the head of the KGB and the head of the Soviet Union, Yuri Andropov, and he did this directly through John Tunney, who had been a former law school roommate of Kennedy and was a Democratic senator from California from 1971 to 77. But May 1983, so Kennedy reaches out with a private offer to work against Reagan. And literally, this is the words of the classified KGB memo of May 14, 1983, to quote-unquote counter the militaristic policies, quote-unquote, of Reagan, and this is an exact phrase too, Frank, to influence Americans toward the Soviet position. And Kennedy, the KGB memo written by the head of the KGB, Viktor Chebrikov, May 14, 1983, directly to the head of the USSR, Yuri Andropov, the memo said that Kennedy is very disturbed by Reagan, but very impressed with Yuri Andropov, very impressed with Andropov. I reported this in 2006 in my book, The Crusader. Kennedy was still alive. I reported it in 2010 in the first edition of Dupes. It's out again in Dupes, which we just released in paperback, both the original Russian document and the English translation. And here's the kicker on this, Frank. I have never been contacted one time, I swear, by CNN, Washington Post, New York Times, nobody. And if I had found a memo like this today in the form of Donald Trump in the 2016 presidential campaign, the Democrats would be drawing up impeachment papers right now.
Well, they're doing it even in the absence of it, of course. But the point is well taken, Paul Kenger, that this is a smoking gun of collusion of the most, well, I think, traitorous kind, quite frankly. And Paul, unfortunately, Teddy Kennedy is not the only example, it seems, of people who have had dalliances or worse with social democrats, as they're called, or even communists in some cases. In addition to your own great work, a mutual friend and colleague of ours, Trevor Loudon, has done some incredible factual, evidentiary-based analyses of something on the order of 150 sitting members of the United States Congress who have these kinds of associations. I'm wondering, Ronald Reagan, of course, first, I think, came to public attention beyond his film career, of course, by coming out against communists in Hollywood, who he saw firsthand during his time in the trade union movement out there, were actively trying to subvert us from within. This would presumably seem to be very familiar to him, were he to see what's going on today, would it not?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, another researcher, John Rossimondo, like Trevor Loudon, does really good work
at the Investigative Project on Terrorism. Good colleague.
That's right. You know him. And he estimates that it could be as high as 50 to 60 current members of the Democratic Congress that are members of the Democratic Socialists of America, the DSA, which prides itself as the largest single socialist group in America today. And, I mean, that group has huge influence. Communist Party USA, John Bechtel, is the current chairman of CPUSA. He let slip in a piece that's posted at the CPUSA website right now that they have only about 5,000 members in Communist Party USA. And it's funny, Frank, because he had been saying a few months ago that they're having this surge in membership under Donald Trump. Well, they must have surged from about 4,800 to about 5,000. is that, I think, but you pretty much put all these people in a sandbox. There's not that many of them.
But to the extent that they've got ties into members of Congress, that's a problem.
That's exactly right. That's and what tends to be happening with the radical left in America today, it's not that they're signing up for CPUSA like Frank Marshall Davis did. In fact, his CPUSA number was 47544. And by the way, every member of the Hollywood 10 under Reagan, all 10 out of 10 were Communist Party USA members. There are about 100,000 members of Communist Party USA in the 1930s. But today they're going into groups like the Democratic Socialists of America. They're voting for Bernie Sanders. They're not calling themselves openly Marxist-Leninists. They're calling themselves progressives. They formed a group in 2008 called Progressives for America, which included people like Mark Rudd, Tom Hayden, Carl Davidson, old SDSers, old Weather Underground people, Bill Ayers, Bernadine Dorn. So in a way, and this gets back to what we were saying earlier, Frank, the threats today are in a way even worse because they're harder to pin down. You can't find them all in CPUSA or in the Comintern or in Moscow.
But you find them in a lot of our universities and other civil society institutions, it goes without saying. Not at Grove City College, let the record show, I'm sure, but elsewhere. Hey, listen, we're almost out of time, and I did want to touch on one other thing. President Reagan, as you know, considered one of the very important fronts in his time's war for the free world to be Latin America. We're watching, as you know, Paul Kenger, the unraveling of one of these communist-dominated nations, the long-suffering country of Venezuela, to the point now where literally one of the countries, I believe it's still the case, with the largest natural reserves of oil is bankrupt and is starving its people and unable to provide electricity or food or water. It's a desperate situation that seems to be perpetuated, at least in part, by the Cubans, as well as the Russians and the Chinese and the Iranians. And I wonder if you could just channel Ronald Reagan for us on this. Would he be regarding this as a threat every much to our country as, say, you know, the challenge from the Danny Ortegas and the Sandinistas in the past?
Yeah, that's a good parallel, Frank. And one thing Reagan would have said is he would have said, only under communism, right, could you have a country with one of the world's largest oil reserves go bankrupt, right? And that is a perfect testimony to what Hugo Chavez called 21st century socialism. And when you look at 21st century socialism, Frank, you see that it looks a lot like 20th century communism. People lining up for toilet paper, people running to the stores to buy everything that they can off the shelves, then they get the stuff home, and the dictator comes out and accuses them of hoarding, right, and calls them capitalist reptiles. And like Reagan said, communism is a form of insanity.
And presumably he would be insisting that we be leading in resisting this. And I pray that Donald Trump will do the same. I know he missed the recent summit of the Americas, and the opportunity perhaps to say that very directly to the people who are on the ground and in place to help bring an end to this terrible, terrible nightmare in Venezuela. Paul Kenger, your insights into the kinds of leadership that we have provided in the past and that we need to be doing in the future is incredibly important. Come back to us again very soon. I hope the rest of you will do the same. Again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.